From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we explore Northwestern Mutual's new garden plaza at the end of Wisconsin Avenue. In direct contrast to the curves and private nooks of Frederick Law Olmsted design, the plaza is all open access and straight lines.
You know, when people laid the first railroad track that went to a straight line to a horizon, it's, you know, a fantastic, arresting human thing. What I love about the Northwestern Mutual Gardens is that it reflects, it celebrates the rectilinearity of the city.
Then Radio Chipstone explores how certain African textiles facilitate the conversation between the living and the dead.
When he goes inside and they close the cloth around him, he transforms. He becomes a spiritual entity. He goes into an altered state of consciousness. He goes into trance.
Plus, we'll have the latest edition of our storytelling series, Exfabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Tom Bamberger is not shy. The award-winning photographer and architecture critic is known for his acerbic take on the shortcomings of Milwaukee's architecture and public spaces.
So it was a bit of a surprise when Bamberger recently sent me a review that was downright glowing. In fact, this article followed a previous one that was equally fulsome. So before we got to the review subject itself, I was curious where all this positivity was coming from.
I wouldn't call it a New Year's resolution, but it did occur to me that on the internet, there is so much sourness sort of permeates our culture that I have made an effort to write more about things that I love. And I think ultimately that has a larger impact. It's very easy to diss things, to be superior to something. But when you love something or you get behind it in a fulsome way, I think it's a little more vulnerable. It's a little more meaningful.
Present, maybe.
Yeah.
Even.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And what you're talking about in this article are the gardens, Northwestern Mutual's gardens.
Yes.
What is it that you love about them?
Well, I guess the first thing, and I've always wanted to say this on the radio, I'm a critic of urban design, and most of the stuff that I cover is where people are just sort of faking it. You know, they're trying to make a buck, and they're not really trying. They're just trying to get the building built and to get it through the committees. But this is a case where they really tried, where they hired a really fantastic and well-known landscape architect named James Burnett, and they really tried. And there's so much I like about it, but the one thing, if you remember, they used to have this little park there that was sort of like an Olmstedian park. It had kind of a curvy path, and it had trees.
Lots of trees.
Yeah, lots of trees that buffered the sidewalk in the city. And that's a very familiar kind of landscape. But what really caught my eye is the rationality of this landscape. It's classically drawn. There's lots of straight lines, lots of rectangles, which has been something that has been totally removed from our landscape. It's a completely new thing in America.
For designed landscapes
since, well, if you look at all of our parks.
Basically Olmsted.
Olmsted, right.
So the idea, you know, I always think of Olmsted as something that's supposed to be organic. There's these fluid shapes, and
exactly.
It's almost amoebic, you know. And so the idea here is that they're getting away from that, or that they have gotten away from
that. Yes. So Olmsted, I got into a little trouble in my article because if you look in the comments section, because I said something about Olmsted that he hated cities, and there's all these people in Milwaukee that love Olmsted because they love Lake Park, and you know, my dad wanted his ashes in Lake Park. Everybody loves Lake Park, but Olmsted, and you're exactly right, Olmsted actually was a big proponent of cities. He was a progressive, and he saw the potential for cities to create new ways of living. And he even wrote about women. You know, women didn't have to work on the farm. They could be involved with culture. And there was a division of labor in cities that allowed all these possibilities, all this opportunity. But during the time that he was forming his ideas, cities were an absolute disaster. They were a cesspool. I mean, New York City, from 1820, it grew from 152,000 to 1 million people.
On the island of Manhattan.
From 1860 to 1820. And then there were these just cataclysmic problems with sanitation and so forth. So if you read Stieglitz's letters to O'Keefe, leaving the city, the country home was basically a health club.
And so was Central Park meant to be a respite?
Yes,
in the city?
No. And so he actually talks about it very explicitly as a prophylactic. It was therapeutic. And you're right about the organic shapes. He hated the grid. And he wanted to create these organic shapes, and everything is like organic, swirls around in Milwaukee and all the Olmstedian things. But it's also been adopted in golf courses and all the suburbs. They took this grammar of Olmsted. To give you a break from the city, and if you go to Central Park, you notice that there's always like a line of trees. You're supposed to leave the city because the city, though not in principle a bad thing, was a nightmare. Was a literally pathogenic, as they called it. And there were writings about this. This isn't, you know, about the therapeutic qualities of nature. And he thought that he was making the city livable and civilized. And it goes along with the Jeffersonian idea of the goodness of the country. And most of the intellectuals, you know, kind of thought the city was like a bad thing. And the country was what renewed you and gave you good values.
Get back to nature, the idea
yes.
of getting back.
Right.
Well, and I find it so funny because when you look at the Olmstedian type of park, Lake Park being a perfect example, mm-hmm. We tend to forget, I think, that that was just as constructed as this new garden
exactly.
in front of Northwestern Mutual, that it's no more quote-unquote natural.
Right.
One is no more natural than the
Olmsted
other.
Olmsted used more explosives to make Central Park than was used in the Civil War. It's a crazy thing. And, you know, the amount of trees and so forth. No, so it is a construction. It's a pastoral construction. And what's interesting is this was a response to really unlivable cities, cities that didn't have sanitation. All of a sudden, skyscrapers are going up, you know, this incredible growth of urban life. So now what I find fascinating is now all of a sudden we can go back to the grid. Now, there's the Kylie Gardens in front of the PAC, which is probably the first one, and I think that's 60s or 70s. Nothing happened since then. Kylie was a lone wolf. Then there's the Kylie straight line thing in front of the museum. But now, if you notice, underneath the freeway, the new freeway construction by Lincoln Moore Drive, there's actually a grid of trees, which is a completely new thing. And I think grids and straight lines, all the things that Olmsted hated, is our nature, something about human beings. You know, one of the greatest things we ever did was geometry, to imagine a straight line. There are really no straight lines in nature. You know, when people first laid the first railroad track that went to a straight line to a horizon, it's, you know, a fantastic, arresting human thing. So the grammar, what I love about the Burnett thing, the Northwestern Mutual Gardens, is that it reflects, it celebrates the rectilinearity of the city rather than trying to buffer. You can look in the ordinances. There's 58 different mentions of buffering in the city ordinances.
For any kind of greenery or park.
Yeah,
or
you
something.
Buffer. You have okay. to buffer all of these things. But now we've, you know, all the industries moved out of cities. We're not slaughtering pigs in cities anymore. We actually have sanitation. We're not walking in human
excrement.
Excrement, yeah, thanks. I was looking for the right word there.
The one we can say on the radio.
The one you can say on the radio, right. And now that, you know, people are living in a city, unlike any city that's ever existed in
America.
And
by choice.
And by choice. And understanding they're interested in the connectivity of a city. Now we have this garden that is really connected. When you walk through it, you realize how, first of all, how it sweeps around the building, which sweeps, and how connected it is to that, but how it fits into, rather than buffers, this sort of rectilinearity of the city. And the same thing's happening under the freeway, and I'm thinking, wow, that's interesting. It was just a given that if you wanted something nice, in quotes, you'd have to have a curvy, you know, people wanted to live at the end of the cul-de-sac.
Quote, unquote, natural, going
right.
back to that, you know, this.
Natural.
But constructed natural.
Yes.
And I'm going back to something you said about the idea of the grid, the straight line is very human. And it almost seems like in the case of this garden, if we're going to construct nature, which is what we're doing with any of this, we might as well construct it to represent what we are and who we are.
You know, I would put it a slightly different way, but I think you're right. I don't know that we really know who we are. Human beings aren't that smart. We think we know, but I'm not so sure we do. But I do think that one thing that human beings do, I mean, if you've ever seen a picture many times in France, the landscape, they may have a road and just perfect line trees down the road. You know, things that stand out where human beings have interacted with the landscape that are not, in quotes, organic, are just fascinating and wonderful and arresting. Now, I studied evolutionary theory in college and in graduate school, and of course, Darwin wouldn't think that anything human beings do would be inorganic. It's kind of a weird Christian idea that nature is good and we are bad, but we're actually part of nature. And our beehive, things that we make, we do straight lines, we do boxes. Now with a computer,
we like symmetry.
Right, we can do curvy things.
Yep.
But I think there's something about the rectilinear, the 90-degree angle in a straight line, the sharpness of it, the clarity of it, that has also been, you know, exploited in minimalist art in the 20th century. It was a huge discovery of sort of just basic human shapes.
Well, and from your article, you both not only like the design, you like being in it. You mm-hmm. like actually spending time in the space.
Right.
So from the pictures, I mean, I've walked by it. Mm-hmm. I have not spent time in it. For you, when you approach it, what is it that feels welcoming to you? Is it that rectilinearity, or is it a combination of that and something else?
I don't know that welcoming, you know, let me put it this way. We like to think that nature is good and it's there for us and it cares about us. But in many ways, you know, nature, of course, is indifferent. And in some ways, what's arresting about an organized space is that it's unnatural, that it's...
We've kept nature at bay.
Yes, that nature, it's all those little crooks and crannies and all that chaos, something that you can't really wrap your mind around, has been organized, linearized, clarified, refined, and that we've exerted control.
I was going to say, some would say sanitized, that's has all been sanitized so that it's more appealing to us.
Oh.
I don't know.
Yeah, see, I would think that the sort of diluted Olmstedian landscape
is more sanitized.
It's more like those, you know, those tissues you buy with cute little designs on them to wipe your butt, you know, or whatever. Like, you don't want to just have a regular white piece of paper that you pull off and it's a perfect rectangle. We put some curvy design on it, you know.
Yep.
But no, I think there's a bit of awe when you go in there because the space is variegated and there's different levels. And when you're up by the building, the sweep of the building and then the sweep of the city is all of this man-made, and then, of course, there's the lake, is kind of inspiring. If you think about nature where we lived, when people came over the Appalachian Mountains into what was called the West at the time, they couldn't see anywhere more than 30 feet because it was all trees. You know, we cut down trees to make fields. And to create these spaces is kind of, rather than it being cloistered and, you know, sitting around a bush. I always think that the Olmstedian idea for the suburbs is that everybody, rather than looking at a beautiful building or the sweep of architecture or something man-made, they get to look at their very own bush. That's, you know, that's the great thing. And this is not looking at a bush. It's not being hemmed in. It's open and expansive. And straight lines have a kind of Euclidean infinity associated with them. You know, they kind of can go on forever in your mind. So the way the lines sort of connect up with the larger world is, that's kind of breathtaking. It's also exposed as people. People are on precipices. They're exposed. This isn't where everybody's in their little nook and private. People are on display, much like, you know, Juno Park used to be, where people used to promenade around. So it's a good place to watch people. I mean, it's not finished yet. It'll be very interesting for me to see how it's inhabited you know, this summer. And I'm sure that in the plaza area, they'll have events and so forth. And the trees are going to grow. But even if you look at all the gardening, it is rational. There's a block of this sort of plant, a block of this. You could even say it's kind of crude, but in the sense that if a child did it, they might, you know, make a block of this and a block of that. But there's something, the simplicity of it, I think, is kind of courageous rather than sort of messing it all up.
How does it work with the building?
Wonderfully. It's reverent to the building. And, you know, the building has this fantastic sweep to it.
And it is curved.
Yes. Oh, no, it has a beautiful arc to it. There are ordinances where, and if you look at a lot of landscaping at McDonald's or whatever, or even at old-fashioned apartment buildings, they always have bushes buffering, you know, even the suburbs, buffering the intersection between the lawn or the landscape and the building. Like there's something obscene there. This design celebrates the seam between the building and the land. It's naked. It's bare. It's explicit. Everything's explicit. You get to see all the moving parts. Nothing's obscured. So,
and you are, from what you're saying, you are one of the moving parts.
Yes.
If you're in that space.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And yes, absolutely. So I just so appreciate, I mean, I think that this kind of landscape and, you know, what's under the freeway, I think it's going to really change the way a lot of people see urban spaces. You know, it's kind of ironic, though. Don't you think it's ironic that, you know, Olmsted was really anti-urbanist to the cities of today? He was an urbanist in the cities of his day that were cesspools. But we've somehow canonized this anti-urbanist design. And I don't want to, I mean, people are going to just hate me. I mean, I love Olmsted.
No, but you're talking about of his time,
yes.
It made sense. The
yes.
design made sense. We're in a different time, and we use cities in a different way. We live in them in a different
exactly.
way. We interact with them in a different way. And so there's nothing, to me, that's sacred about hanging on to a design that no longer works for the way you use a space.
Well, you know, I'm not going to say it doesn't work at all. It works some of the time. What's amazing to me is how it is more or less a religion. Every single suburb, golf courses, every single constructed landscape has these curvy and the almond ponds and that this grammar has, it's sort of like a kudzu that has overrun, you know. And so I think this is such a relief. And Burnett has really sort of integrated Kylie and Olmsted to a certain extent. But it's just so interesting, Kylie having these two pieces here, and I think they want to get rid of the Grove at the PAC. I heard some rumor that would be stupid, of course. But the fact that Kylie was such a lone wolf in America. I met him right before he died when he came to Milwaukee. And if you look at his things, they were just amazing. He worked with Saarinen in a lot of projects, but his modernist idea of the rational landscape was totally rejected by America. So I guess what
I... So do you think this is a turning point?
I think it's a turning point in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at what's under the freeway, I mean, grids are fantastic. A grid of trees is a organized orchards are fantastically beautiful. And you know how people learn from their immediate environment? I think that we're going to see the land around buildings organized in a different way.
And yeah. We will talk about it.
Yes.
When it happens.
Yes.
So, Tom Bamberger, always great to have you in the studio. Happy 2018, and we will talk again soon.
Nice seeing you, Bonnie.
Photographer and architecture critic Tom Bamberger's review of Northwestern Mutual's Garden Plaza is at Urban Milwaukee, and you'll find a link and pictures at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, Radio Chipstone visits an exhibit of Yoruba garments that bridge the living and the dead. That comes your way when Lake Effect Weekend continues right after this on Milwaukee's NPR. It's Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. If you look to your left as you walk into the School of Human Ecology on the UW-Madison campus, you'll see something wondrous in the design gallery window. The exhibit is called Whirling Return of the Ancestors, Igungun, Arts of the Yoruba in Africa and Beyond. The garment in the window is worn in what's called a masquerade.
Henry Druell is a professor of art history, Afro-American studies, and an adjunct curator of African art at the Chazen Museum. He and his students are the curators of the exhibit. The whirling garment in the window welcomes visitors into a world where the living and the dead are bound together by cloth.
In this edition of Radio Chipstone, Professor Druell spoke with contributor Jennifer Fields about the Yoruba peoples of West Africa and how they connect with their ancestors through masquerades.
A masquerade implies an entity that's within, okay? So the word for a masquerade, one type of masquerade among the Yoruba, is egungun. It's difficult to define it, but one of the ways we understand it is to think of egungun as powers concealed. Because an egungun ensemble, mostly made out of cloth, entirely encloses a performer. But that performer is not who he was before he goes inside that ensemble. When he goes inside and they close the cloth around him, he transforms. He becomes a spiritual entity. He goes into an altered state of consciousness. He goes into trance. He is transformed into the spirit of an ancestor to celebrate that ancestor in dance and in song. And that's what an egungun is. Now, everybody knows that there's somebody performing it, but they also will not call the name, even if they know who's performing in a particular ceremony and so on. They would never call the name of that person because that isn't who's performing. They've changed, they've transformed. And it's this artistic performance that is actualizing the connection between this world of the living and the other world of the ancestors.
So when we think about when someone is wearing the egungun, would it be for a holiday as we think about a holiday, or would it be for a special event that's particular to the Yoruba?
You can call it a holiday. The egungun will come out during major annual festivals, so there's an annual cycle of renewal that affirms the identity and the unity of the families who perform these egungun masquerades. But if an important person passes away, departs, they were powerful and important in the community might get together and put together a funeral commemoration of that departed individual. So that can happen anytime during the year. But when all of the egungun from the different families and the different parts of a town or a city or a village come together, that's on an annual basis.
So let's walk and look at one of the egunguns over here.
Sure, yes.
Talk to me about this piece that we're standing in front of.
One of the objectives in this exhibition was to try to make it multi-sensorial. I believe that we need to engage all of our senses if we're to fully appreciate and understand and comprehend the experiences that we're having from moment to moment and day to day in our lives. So museum exhibitions usually are sensory deprivation spaces. That is, you do not touch the work, you're usually quiet, you don't make a lot of noise. Usually in an art exhibition, there's no sound. We wanted to do just the opposite. We wanted to bring these arts to life through the senses. So I have at least two ensembles that are whirling around. They are moving. They are performing. One by a former student of mine, Moyo Okediji, and the other is a new one that we commissioned from West Africa that's shown revolving around. And then the third is this incredible film of two festivals, one in Porto Novo, West Africa, and another from Oyo Tunji Village in South Carolina. 12.5 minutes of film that shows the incredible artistry of these egungun performers. One of the other things I wanted to do was not only have the sound with the film, but I wanted people to hear the voice of an ancestor. So there is one egungo, an old egungo in the exhibition that's in the Helen Louise Allen textile collection, in which we have inserted an audio tape of the voice of an ancestor from Lagos, Nigeria, West Africa. So as I stand close to this egungo, you're hearing the voice of an ancestor from Lagos.
What is he saying?
He's greeting the people in the room. He's blessing them. He's praying for them. He's also giving praise names that are associated with his family and his ancestors and his descendants who are there in the room to celebrate him.
Is it fair to say then, Henry, that cloth is one of the things that binds that relationship, that forms that relationship? Because I'm looking here on the wall and I see the quote that cloth only wears to shreds. Is that how people maintain connection with the spirit world? Is it through cloth?
For the Yoruba, yes. Cloth is very, very important. And that saying, cloth only wears to shreds, is saying that cloth may wear out. It may get tired. It may shred, but it never disappears. It's everlasting, just like our connection to our departed ancestors. And that's why cloth is the major gift. It's the major offering that descendants give to their ancestors. That's why these egungo ensembles are made of elaborate cloth, hand-woven, stitched, narrow-band cloth that's like a shroud, a burial shroud. And then on top of it are layers and layers and layers added from annual festival to annual festival. Cloth that is purchased in the marketplaces, cloth that is worn and then given to the making of the ensemble by family members, both women and men, and young children will contribute in various ways to making this communal creation, which is the tangible, visible, material representation of the unity and the identity of the family that creates it.
And if the person who wears them, does the egungun call to them, or do they make the decision to engage with the egungun? How does that work?
Okay, those families that have egungun in their tradition, not all families produce egungun. They honor their ancestors in different ways. But the families that do it through egungun will have members who are officials in the egungun society. They meet regularly. They rehearse and prepare in secret. They dress in secret. All of this is done out of the view of the public before they come out into the public to perform. The choice of performers is done through divination. The family will check through a diviner. Either an elder in the family will do divination, and they'll either use cowrie shells or kola nuts, or they'll go to an ifa diviner who uses ikin ifa, these are palm nuts, to determine who should perform.
So the egungun that you have here now, if they belong to a family and someone has to be called to perform the masquerade in them, then how do they end up here?
That's because egungo are continually being replaced, renewed, changed. When one gets too old, maybe it's old-fashioned. They don't want to bring it out. They're making a new one for the new festival that's coming. So they, the families can jointly decide to sell an egungo, and there have been collectors and dealers who have gone to be and talk to families about that. Some of the egungo are literally retired. They no longer come out. There are always new ones that are being produced.
When these egungo are retired,
yeah,
would it be considered disrespectful to wear it?
Yeah, it wouldn't be appropriate. First of all, you have to have egungo tradition in your lineage. If it's part of your family's tradition, then you should participate in some way. Families who don't have the egungo tradition wouldn't take on an egungo. It would be disrespectful. It just wouldn't be appropriate because there are different ways to honor the departed. This is just one way. And if it was retired, it was probably retired because it's not in good shape. That is, it might the stitching might be weak, there might be some tears, and the person inside must never be seen visibly in performance. So they check and double check and triple check the ensemble to make sure that it will completely enclose the person who's going inside, because otherwise it becomes dangerous for them.
Someone who is not familiar with tradition and walks into this room, what do you want them to walk away with?
Well, I want them to come to have an understanding about one African culture's way of honoring ancestors and how important that is, and how much artistry, whether in the sewing and the making of the ensembles or in the songs that are sung or in the dances that are performed, to show how important and how vital and beautiful they are coming from this African culture known as the Yoruba. That's what I'd love for them to take away. And in seeing the Yoruba tradition, to think about themselves, to think about their own ancestors and how they honor them. Do they do it with, a gravestone in a cemetery? Do they do it by scattering ashes in a favorite place of that departed individual? How do they honor the past? Because this African tradition of honoring ancestors is really universal to cultures around the world. And I wanted to at least share this tradition that I know a little bit about with my students and this public in Wisconsin.
Material culture contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
This week, Jennifer spoke with Henry Druel, the Eve Jew Bascom Professor of Art History and Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison. He's also adjunct curator of African art at the Chazen Museum of Art.
Friday night at Turner Hall, the 5th annual Milwaukee Gospel Jubilee took place, and among the groups performing were the Spiritual Tones, a group of young performers, the next generation of gospel singers.
Cherise Love, Quan Clark, and Sean Winston are members of the Spiritual Tones, and they sang this song for us in our performance studio earlier this week.
One, two. I stopped by to tell somebody he did not wake me up early this morning.
But he did.
He did not start me on my way, but he did.
But he did.
I could have been dead in my grave, but you made old Dev stand back and behave. So glad.
So glad.
Yes, I'm glad.
So glad.
Oh, Lord.
So glad he did.
Come on, put those hands
together. Everybody clap your hands. Everybody clap your
Everybody.
Hands. We come to praise the Lord.
I said I stopped by to tell somebody he did not wake me up early this morning.
No, but he did.
He did not start me on my way, but he did.
But he did.
I could have been dead in my grave, but you made old Dev stand back and behave. So glad.
So glad.
I'm glad.
So glad.
Oh, Lord.
So glad he did.
Ooh, I'm glad
he did.
Anybody glad he
did? He did.
Anybody glad he did it?
He did.
Jesus did.
He did.
And I could remember.
He did.
When I was in my sin.
He did.
Wasn't nobody but Jesus.
He did.
That took me on in.
He did.
And I could remember.
He did.
I had it down
the road. He did.
Jesus came.
He did.
And lifted my heavy load.
He did.
Yes, he did.
He did.
Yes, he did.
He did.
Yes, he did it.
He did.
Yes, he did it.
He did.
So glad.
So glad he did.
Anybody glad he did.
So glad he did.
Anybody glad he did.
So glad he did.
Let me tell you what the Lord did.
So glad he did.
Woke me up.
So glad he did. So glad he did.
Didn't let Satan harm me.
So glad he did.
Look at what the Lord did.
So glad he did.
I can remember.
So glad he did.
When I was down and out.
So glad he did.
Jesus came.
So glad he did.
And he brought me out.
So glad he did.
And if you're glad he did.
So glad he did.
And if you're glad he did.
So glad he did.
You want to throw up your hands.
So glad he did.
And tell the Lord.
So glad he did.
Oh, I want to thank
thank you, Jesus.
Lord,
thank you,
I thank him,
Jesus.
For
oh, thank you,
I thank him,
Jesus.
For reason.
Thank you,
I thank him,
Jesus.
Food.
Thank
me
you,
through.
Jesus.
Thank
you,
I thank him,
Jesus.
I got to
thank
tell
you,
him,
Jesus.
I'm gonna thank him.
Thank you,
Lord. I know you've been,
Lord. I know you've been good.
Charisse Love, Quan Clark, and Sean Winston are members of the Spiritual Tones. The group was part of the 5th Annual Milwaukee Gospel Jubilee that took place Friday night at Turner Hall.
We will take one more break, and then it's time for our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on 89.7 WUWM.
One.
Welcome to Ex Fabula!
True personal story.
Ex Fabula!
Ex Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And it is time for Ex Fabula Radio once again, part of Lake Effect Weekend, every weekend on WUWM. I'm Bruce Winter with Ex Fabula co-founder Leah Delaney here in the midst of the bleak midwinter of Milwaukee, but we have some good news. Story Slam's coming back.
Yep. We have a February Story Slam. First time is the theme. And so I brought some first time stories with me. We actually celebrated a first not too long ago during our Ex Fabula Spectacular. We had ASL, American Sign Language Interpretation.
Oh, cool.
Which is fabulous. And I just want to just give a quick shout out, special thank you to Pam Conine and Sandy Smith for your services during our Equal Access Project. And if anybody wants any more information about that, please definitely go to exfabula.org. But today, we're talking about first time. Wow, that really leaves a lot up for interpretation.
Yes, I mean, for a theme for a story slam, who knows what you're going to get.
Exactly. Hopefully, the next two stories we're going to preview today will get people's minds jogged up and starting to think about what they could potentially share with their stories come February 7th. So let's just roll right in.
Yeah.
How about it? Let's listen to Mel Miskimen first, who told her what could go wrong story for our first time Story Slam preview today. Here's Mel.
Okay, I had this picture of Sting in my cubicle at work. It was black and white. I think I ripped it out of the Rolling Stone. He was shirtless. His pants were unbuttoned to the point of no return. I would walk into work and his eyes would meet mine and his gaze would like penetrate my vagina. Okay. So I was turning 35 and it was my birthday and my husband is a notoriously bad gift giver. One year he got me a spatula. One year he got me a bag of wood. You know, so when he handed me the Hallmark card, I was holding out no hope. So I open it up, you know, typical picture. Oh, you're not old, you're vintage, you know. But inside was this little skinny envelope, and I'm like, well, what's this? You know, so I open that up. Oh, what? Two tickets to see Sting at Alpine Valley, his first solo tour since he left the Police. Oh, but wait, there's more. Two backstage passes. Yeah, swing, you know. So I am like, what am I gonna wear? What am I gonna say? You know, this is how I picture it going down. You know, I'm gonna like be all cool and aloof and I'm gonna go up to Sting and I'm gonna say something like so awesome and then Sting and I are gonna bond, but oh, not sexually, come on. I was delusional, I'm not that delusional. So, and I'm figuring he's gonna need me because this rock star lifestyle is so unreal. He's gonna need me to ground him and then he's gonna write a song about me and all this stuff. So we get to Alpine Valley, and we're walking down the main aisle, and, you know, you kind of, we're getting closer to the stage, and I'm like, yeah, I'm one of those people, you know. I kind of look back as the guy opens up the velvet rope, you know. So we get backstage, kind of make our way. My husband pulls me back. He's like, okay, just don't do anything stupid. And I'm like, I take umbrage, sir. You know, so we get to this part. It's kind of an open area backstage. There's the catering and everything. And, oh, my God, there is Sting. He's, like, right there eating a crudité. And he's wearing this diaphanous linen ensemble. And I lose it, okay? I just start jumping up and down, jumping up and down, jumping up and down, like I have just won the Price is Right showcase. Okay, and I'm like getting closer to him, and he's kind of like, I would say not worry on his, but concern. He's got concern on his face. So the next thing I know, I'm being ushered out by security. Yeah. I know. But I look back, I'm like, Sting. And I notice he's got this little tiny piece of a carrot stuck in his teeth. And our relationship has never been the same since.
Thank you. And that was Mel Miskimmet. Very funny little note about that. I emailed her to let her know her story was being aired this weekend, and she's like, oh, goody, maybe Sting will be listening.
Oh, yeah. He's a contributor, too, by the way.
Yeah, he is.
I know I have been backstage a lot in my life, and I've been very fortunate and very lucky to meet a lot of people. And, you know, most artists are, you know, pretty decent people and are pretty nice to you as long as you don't, you know, gush over them or go, you know, oh my God, I think you're the best thing ever. But they're usually pretty nice people. And I only went kind of goofy one time.
Only once?
Only once.
All usually, right.
And that was the first time I met Lucinda Williams.
Oh.
I was just like, I just turned into a blithering idiot. All I could say was, hada-booty blah 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 blah. I could not speak, you know, because I was just in awe of the woman. But that's the only time that's ever happened.
How did she respond to that? Would she just pet your head and say, yeah, oh, okay, good Bruce.
Good boy. Now go back in your room. Yes. No, she was very nice about it. But.
Well, good. Unlike Sting. Just kidding.
Well, you have a little special treat for us.
Yeah, yes.
And that is, at Story Slams, if people don't want to get up and tell their story in front of the crowd, they can write something down.
Yes, yes. There are so many different ways to contribute to an ex-fabulous Story Slam and otherwise. Ultra shorts. There are little teeny pieces of paper we hand out to the audience members who aren't just ready to hop up on stage and tell that 5-minute real true personal story. So they basically can take that that little piece of paper and write down 1 to 5 lines of their little teeny stories relating to the theme of the night. And throughout the evening, us MCs jump up on stage and we just read them off and everybody has a good time and nobody has to get in front of a microphone except for us.
Yeah,
so, yeah. It's
you got
great.
A couple examples, right?
Well, funny you should say that. Yeah. This was actually from one of our Story Slams back in October 2011. The theme was first day, a whole bunch of like first day stories about work and what have you. So I just want to share a handful of these before we roll into our next first time story. So this was told by somebody who's no name, anonymous. You can do that. You don't have to put your name down. And they say, my first day to work at State Fair, I was told to wear my Girl Scout uniform on the Greyhound bus so they would know me to pick me up. Of course, my suitcase was lost, leading me to hang out in the big city only in my Girl Scout uniform. It's very misleading. This is from Megan. The first morning after my first night in my new apartment, I rolled over into my roommate's bed and said, oops, now we share the same bed.
Oops.
And here's another one from Francis. My boss stared at me and asked, why did I hire you? Years later, this ritual occurs about every 3 months. That's a good boss. I like a good boss with a sense of humor.
That's good. I like that.
Here's a couple that are going to lead into our next story here. This one is from C. The first day I met my partner, she was drunkenly drinking from the broken bottleneck of a beer she inconspicuously dropped earlier in the evening. Who knew it would be the first day of the rest of our lives together?
Wow, that was really poetic. Drunkenly drinking from the broken beer bottleneck. Wow, I can't even say it.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's tricky.
That's good. That's very good.
The first day of April, 1966, I got married to my first husband. The date tells it all. Yep, da-da-da-da-da. Awesome. So those are ultra shorts, and we want to definitely get everybody on board with the ultra shorts if you're not ready to tell a story on stage. So let's go right into our next story. This one is also from the same Story Slam, if you would believe it, from our What Could Go Wrong Story Slam event. Here is Gordon Leach.
So, take you back. I was about 21 years old, and I'm at school at college. I've got a job. I'm taking care of college on my own. Money's tight. I'm single, so of course I'm constantly looking for someone to go out with. And I meet this girl, and her name's Koshi. Now, she was, you know, as waspy as I am, and I never expected that name. And I would see her three times a week in class. So I introduce myself, she tells me her name, and for some reason, I could not remember that name. It just didn't fit. So I messed her name up every time I went to talk to her for like the next 2 weeks. But she was really cute, and I think what it was is I was just getting all flustered because I thought she was really cute. I wanted to ask her out. I was shy. And so when I went up to reintroduce myself to her and talk to her, I called her Zachi or some other thing, and she'd correct me every time, very polite, correct me every time, but sure enough, I messed it up the very next time I'd see her. So I got up my nerve, I asked her out just for a lunch date. And so we had planned to go out to lunch the next day, so I went and figured everything out. You know, I had trained myself the whole way walking to the restaurant that her name is Koshi, Koshi, Koshi. I'm going through my head, Koshi, Koshi, Koshi. I even wrote a little K on the palm of my hand. I didn't write out her whole name, just a little K so that I got the K sound, which would be fine. I'd be fine with the rest of it. So, I had $20 to my name. I didn't have it in my wallet, and I still don't carry cash in my wallet, but I had $20 on my debit card. No problem, I knew if I was the gentleman, let her order first. I could do quick math and figure out what I could order. So we go to the restaurant, we have lunch, you know, and it works out nice. I'm happy, she's happy, she's laughing at a couple of my jokes, things are going well. You know, she ordered some sandwich and I got the salad, so I knew it was going to be about $16. I had $3 left over in my account for the tip. So everything was going good. I called her Koshi. You know, we got past that and everything was fine. And I'm thinking there's going to be another date coming down the road. So then the bill comes, and sure enough, it's like $16 and change. So I pull out my debit card, which has my entire savings of $20 on it at that point. And the waiter comes back to take the bill, and I hand the waiter my debit card. And they say, I'm sorry, we don't take debit cards. So then I start fumbling around and trying to figure out how I'm going to pay for this, and I have to just admit to her. And now, of course, I'm feeling like a total idiot once again because having gone through, messed up her name all that time, and now I tell her, I'll be right back. My plan was to go out to the cash machine and get the cash. Well, she ended up paying for the bill, and that was the last time I ever saw her. That's my story. What could have gone wrong?
Met a gal on Sunday, Monday fell in love. Tuesday I said, darling, won't you be my turtle dove? Wednesday bought a diamond ring, Thursday put it on. Friday she met my best friend, Saturday she's gone.
And that was Gordon Leach.
No money for dinner, no second date.
Yeah, exactly. So fantastic. I'm really excited about the Story Slam coming up. It's going to be on February 7th, held at the Lakefront Brewery. So people can grab a cup of courage there. Mm-hmm. tell their story, and then we're going to choose the audience favorite at the end of the night. It's going to be a fabulous night. So, Milwaukee, please show up. Oh, one other thing.
Yes, ma'am.
I mentioned that. We also have a general storytelling workshop coming up, and that's open to the public. And that's going to be on Saturday, February 10th at the AWE, Artists Working in Education. And it's going to be facilitated by our Exfabula fantastic storytelling coaches. So if you're interested in that, or the Story Slam, or the March event coming up, you know, please go to exfabula.org for all things story related.
Excellent. And if you want to hear these again or share these stories with somebody else, they are posted at WUWM.com. And we are here on the radio every Saturday and Sunday, about this time.
Fantastic.
And thanks, we'll do it again next week.
All right.
Exfabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up another edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned now. All Things Considered comes your way next. It's 4 o'clock.